Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the arrest of a 14-year-old Muslim boy who was a member of the robotics club at MacArthur High School in Irving, Texas. He brought a homemade digital alarm clock to school that a teacher decided was a bomb, and young Ahmed Mohammed soon found himself handcuffed and fingerprinted by police who had ignored his pleas that he had built an alarm clock, insisting, "So you tried to make a bomb." Mike Gauss, the executive director of the American Muslim Institution in Washington, D.C., and the former president of the Together Foundation in Dallas, Texas, joins us to discuss this overwrought example of Islamophobia that has provoked outrage, with Facebook's head Mark Zuckerberg tweeting, "Ahmed, if you ever want to come by Facebook, I'd love to meet you. Keep building." And has President Obama tweeting, "Cool clock, Ahmed. Want to bring it to the White House? We should inspire more kids like you to like science. It's what makes America great." Then Victoria Sanford joins us in studio to do a follow-up on people power in Guatemala following the popular uprising that ousted Guatemala's corrupt president, who is now in jail. We'll examine how a young generation of activists using social media are challenging the oligarchical power structure, whose long history of being in league with the brutal military in bed with drug traffickers has turned Guatemala into a narco-democracy. We will look into whether the upcoming election could end the loss of 30% of the country's budget to corruption and deal with the shameful fact that 50% of Guatemalan children suffer from chronic malnutrition in a country with Central America's biggest economy. Then finally, we'll speak with Henry Giroux, the current Global Television Network Chair in English and Cultural Studies at McMaster University in Canada and the co-author of Disposable Future, Violence in the Age of Spectacle. We will discuss his article, "Let Truth Out, Political Frauds and Ghosts of Totalitarianism," and the lack of civic literacy in the U.S. combined with celebrity worship in the press that has led to a casino capitalist's terrifying rise to the top of the GOP in what is an emerging form of new totalitarianism. And joining us now is Mike Gauss, who is the executive director of the American Muslim Institution in Washington, D.C., and formerly the president of the Together Foundation based in Dallas, Texas. His work is listed at mikegauss.net, and his daily blog is at thegaussdiary.com. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mike Gauss.
Good to be with you again, Ian. And you always bring out some good perspectives.
Well, thank you, Mike.
To the nation.
Your old stomping grounds there in Dallas, I know you just moved to Washington, D.C. A hugely embarrassing incident took place at the MacArthur High School in Irving, Texas, which is a suburb of Dallas, where a 14-year-old Muslim boy was arrested. The police were called to the high school because as a school project, he brought in a homemade digital alarm clock that he'd made himself. And he was then, as I said, taken away by the police, handcuffed and fingerprinted. And this has outraged a lot of people in this country, including the President of the United States, who's invited the young man to come to the White House. So what's your response to this as somebody that's trying to bring about interfaith understanding and combating Islamophobia?
Well, thanks for asking me that question. First of all, the problems we have, the conflicts we have between individuals, between communities, and including nations, is because we don't know each other. It is in our interest, the interest of America, to learn about each other. Once we know about each other, conflicts fade and solutions emerge. And this is the case where there is a stereotyping is done about this kid who is from Sudan, and he looks dark, and his name is Muhammad, and the teacher should have been excited and encouraged him. Look what we got. Muhammad got this transistor radio he's made. Let's see how it works. Let's get somebody from the lab to look at it. That should have been the encouragement. We should encourage our kids to be entrepreneurs, creative innovators. Instead, she got panicky. I'm not blaming her at all. And as an American committed to build a cohesive America, her lack of knowledge about others, or there is a fear that has gone into most Americans through our good Fox News, which are very eager to portray everything in a negative way. I think that woman, that teacher, had this fear in her mind that this is what could be the thing. It is good to have caution, there is no doubt. But to panic and put the handcuffs on the boy is ridiculous, and the police are to be ashamed. I'm going to write to the police chief. They should be ashamed to put handcuffs for a 14-year-old boy, and they say that it is for his safety. That's baloney. 14-year-old boy is not a threat, and that kid looks so fragile, and that is a wrong thing to send a message to other kids. I don't know how many kids around the nation that is discouraging. The kids who created Google, Interfaith, Apple. Now, kids, we should encourage them and not discourage them. Islamophobia is for real, just like anti-Semitism. And we, as Americans, Jews, Muslims, Hindus, Christians, Baha'is, Buddhists, have to come together and work with each other and not rejoice that a Muslim was caught, but we should regret, feel sad that it could happen to anyone. It could be a Jewish boy, it could be a Hindu boy, who knows? But as a nation, we need to learn about each other. And I'm surprised in Irving, in Richardson, and other schools in Dallas area, I took my kids there. They have social events once in 3 to 4 months where each kid is asked to present his culture. He bring his food. The families come, mingle, mix. It helps people get to know each other. I don't know if this school where this happened had a program like this. If they didn't, they better have something like this. This is very sad that it is reflecting on Irving School, which are very progressive school. Let me tell you a little story about Irving City. There was a Hindu temple that was being built in the city of Plano and Parker some 25 years ago. The entire city came and they rejected building a Hindu temple with their negativity. Irving welcomed them. Irving welcomed everybody. There are several mosques, several temples of different denominations, and Sikh temples as well. But amidst this, should this happen, I'm really surprised. I think we need to have a orientation and education class for the teachers, that how should they treat a child, 14-year-old kid, when he brings something excited to show to her teacher and she burst his bubble. Not only him, there are so many other kids. It is sad. I'm not blaming the teacher. Teacher needs to learn. Teacher needs to be educated. That's where we need to go and make a difference.
So let's just walk through what happened to this young boy, 14-year-old boy from parents come from Sudan, Ahmed Mohammed. He is a member of the middle school. That's the MacArthur High School in Irving, Texas, the middle school robotics club. And he had already won awards from the robotics club for his previous inventions. And he showed up at school with this alarm clock that he'd made himself, a digital alarm clock. And he showed it to one teacher, and she told him that it was nice, but that he shouldn't show it to other instructors. So the teenager put the clock in his book bag, but then an alarm beeped in the middle of the sixth period, and Arpin showed the teacher what he had, and that's when the teacher said, well, this looks like a bomb. And the young kid said, no, it doesn't look like a bomb to me. It's a digital alarm clock. And then Ahmed gets hauled out of the class. He's brought into a room with four police officers, and the policeman says, yep, that's who I thought it was. And then another officer says to him, so you tried to make a bomb. And it's as though whatever the kids said, it didn't matter. They'd all made up their minds.
And that prejudice needs to go in. And the police, right now, the police is on the wrong end of the history today in America, which is a shame. There is so much going on against police, and then they multiply this prejudice by doing that. He's 14-year-old and telling him that, yes, sir, it looks like a bomb. How idiotic that police officer is. And I think he needs some training, some education, how to deal with children. And these are the things that are happening that should not happen. That police officer owes an apology, but the bright thing about whole thing, as you mentioned, Ian, I am so glad President Obama has invited this by. It assures all those people who look dark, who aspire to be engineers, entrepreneurs. It is an encouragement by President. I cannot salute more to our President for doing this act of kindness and building an America where no American has to live in fear of the other American. Thank you so much, President Obama, for doing this. I salute you.
Well, specifically what the President did, he tweeted out to this 14-year-old boy, this is the President Obama's tweet at POTUS, "Cool clock, Ahmed. Want to bring it to the White House? We should inspire more kids like you to like science. It's what makes America great." And then the head of Facebook, Mark Zuckerberg, tweeted, "You've probably seen the story about Ahmed, the 14-year-old student in Texas who built a clock and was arrested when he took it to school. Having the skill and ambition to build something cool should lead to applause, not arrest. The future belongs to people like Ahmed. Ahmed, if you ever want to come by Facebook, I'd love to meet you. Keep building."
So, wow. Wow. I almost want to cry. You know what, Ian, this is doing by Obama and Zuckerman? Around the world, in different countries, the Muslims, I'm looking from their point of view, they will try to make fun of us Americans. Look what they are doing. But these two guys have negated everything that has happened. I am so proud of America. I'm so proud of Mark Zuckerman and President Obama for doing this. It tells the entire world how good a people we are, how caring we are. Thank you so much for doing this show, and thanks for giving hope to those with less hope, those who want to thrive. You are show what you are doing is amazing. Ian, I cannot thank you enough for doing this program.
Well, of course, you know, in the rest of the news media today, Mike Gauss, we're seeing some hideous images on the border with Hungary and Serbia, the Hungarian military and police using water cannons and tear gas and pepper spray on desperate refugees from Syria, from Afghanistan, trying to get to Europe, escaping the wars in their countries, being treated abominably. So this is not something that's exclusive to the United States. And I think the last time you and I spoke was when there was that big hate fest down in Dallas, Texas, organized by Pamela Geller, that ended up with the shooting of these two hapless jihadis. So I guess, you know, we just have to keep pointing out, it's tragic, but I guess our job is to point out the absolute absurdity of these kind of racist right-wing prejudice that we see around the world.
Well, on the right wing, I have been thinking about it. In my speech tomorrow, I was going to address it. Actually, right-wing people are honestly, sincerely misinformed. They are motivated by some unknown fear. I would like to sit down with them and find out, put it on the table, what is your fear? What are you afraid of? And let's address them and find solutions instead of being at each other's throats. It's not going to solve. If I frighten you, Ian, I am also frightened, worrying that in my weak moment you might get me. So both of us are in fear. The best thing is to sit down and talk. And one of the things through American Muslim Institution we are going to do is work with every organization, work with the right wing. And I believe honestly, sincerely, that they are misinformed. Once they see a different point of view, more than likely some of that phobia will mitigate. I honestly believe it, and I'm going to work on it, and I need help from all the media like yours, including Sean Hannity, to give me the space and room to communicate, to build an America where nobody has to feel afraid of anybody.
So do you think on tonight's debate with the Republican candidates, we don't know what the moderators, what questions they're going to ask, but this is very much in the news. It seems like an appropriate question to ask at least the 11 candidates in the main debate what their opinions are about the treatment of this boy.
I fully agree. I do hope CNN asks that question and see how they respond. And that response will tell the Americans, are they for an America together? Are they for a divisive America? As a president, are they going to put America together? Are they tear it apart? And that's where we need to judge the candidates by their response. I sincerely hope they ask this question.
Well, Mike, what are you doing tomorrow? You mentioned you're giving a speech tomorrow.
Tomorrow we have a launch of the American Muslim Institution at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. And we are going to begin a new chapter in America of working together to build an America where everyone can be proud of, where no one has to be afraid of each other. And that is the launch. Ambassador Siddiqui and I will be speaking along with our chairman of the board and Congressman Keith Ellison, Congressman Andre Carson will be speaking as well. We're expecting about 70 to 75 people attendance, including the media.
Well, I wish you all the best tomorrow, Mike, and I thank you for joining us.
Thank you so very much.
And again, I've been speaking with Mike Gauss, who is the executive director of the American Muslim Institution in Washington, D.C., and the former president of the Together Foundation based in Dallas, Texas. His work is listed at mikegauss.net, and his daily blog is thegaussdiary.com. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back with a follow-up on people power in Guatemala.
Going in from every crevice, every crack. Anybody wanna tell it like it is to each other, like you would to a sister or a brother? Cut this out, cosmopolitan style.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now in the studio is cultural anthropologist Victoria Sanford, who studies human rights, international humanitarian law, the anthropology of genocide, race, and gender in the Americas, and child soldiers within Guatemala, Colombia, and South Africa. She is the director of the Center for Human Rights and Peace Studies based at Lehman College, City University, New York, and has spent years uncovering evidence of genocide in Guatemala. Welcome to Background Briefing, Victoria Sanford.
Thank you so much, Ian.
And what's the next step now that there's been, first of all, the former head of state in Guatemala, the President Otto Perez Molina, went straight from the palace to jail, and then there was an election which people tried to delay, but nevertheless it went ahead, and the handpicked successor lost. The comedian came in first, but he's in a runoff with the so-called leftist candidate. So what's the next step in terms of civil society? That movement that got rid of this corrupt president, can it coalesce around all of the incredible problems that this country faces?
Well, I think in terms of the elections, that probably it will coalesce around Sandra Torres, who's the candidate that's referred to as the left-wing candidate, but really I would say she's probably center-right, only because she believes in social programs and that the state should provide social services like education and health care.
And that is, of course, amongst, I think Guatemala is the most shameful amongst the world in terms of those statistics.
Absolutely. Absolutely. They're like if you look at the healthcare, the social welfare index, any measurements of what gives human dignity to people in daily life, the number of children who are hungry in Guatemala today, the majority of children in Guatemala right now while we're speaking are hungry.
Well, that's one of the most outrageous statistics. 50% of Guatemalan children suffer from chronic malnutrition, which is one of the highest rates in the world. The World Bank says that Guatemala collects the lowest taxes in the world and spends the least on health, education, and infrastructure as a proportion of its economy. So this is global statistics. They are the world's worst.
Right. And these are global statistics provided by the World Bank, which is a conservative entity that's just looking at straight stats on the country. And one of the things I think is always interesting to point out, when people look at Central America, they look at Costa Rica and talk about Costa Rica as being a democratic space and a space where people receive services, and that is an area where there hasn't been the kind of conflict that we've seen in other parts of Central America. Costa Rica, compared to Guatemala, is actually a quite poor country. Guatemala is much richer than Costa Rica is, but Costa Rica has a better distribution of wealth, whereas Guatemala doesn't. And that is exactly what the problem is in the country, is that the majority of people are marginalized and they're hungry. Not only are they not able to fully participate as citizens in daily life, but they don't have access to the minimum services that we consider necessary for full citizenship in society.
Well, Guatemala has the biggest economy in Central America, according to the World Bank.
Absolutely. It's a rich country. It's not a poor country. It's the distribution of wealth that's the problem there,
right.
The inequality and inequities in everything from the resources to civil society participation to access to basic services, but also to land ownership. It has the highest concentration of land ownership. And if you look at the social index that's provided by the United Nations, in almost every single category of social welfare, it's either Guatemala or Haiti are at the bottom.
Right. Well, this is particularly upsetting and deeply ironic to think that we just had this example of President Otto Perez Molina going to jail. What's he being charged with? Siphoning off customs money for himself at the behest of big importers who he makes a deal with. I'm going to lower you. You wanted to pay your import duty. So here's a rich guy representing the rich guys, pocketing money that should go to the national treasury.
Right. So basically what you have is a country where rich people in the country don't pay taxes, and people, big business coming in from outside the country, give bribes to the president and the vice president and their cronies instead of paying taxes. So there is no tax base. Millions of dollars are lost that way.
Sounds like the United States.
Well, I mean, it also brings up some really interesting issues to think about in terms of trafficking, because when we look at Guatemala or Central America, we think about the trafficking of drugs, because drugs are trafficked through there from Colombia, and cocaine moves through there, which brings money laundering, et cetera. But Guatemala and other parts of Central America, like other parts of the Southern Hemisphere, are not only affected by drug trafficking, illicit trafficking, but it's illegal trafficking of legal goods. And that's what Perez Molina was involved in. Those are legal goods that are being brought into the country, but it's illegal trafficking because they're not paying the duties that they should be paying to come in. So it eliminates any kind of tax base for the country.
And again, I'm speaking with cultural anthropologist Victoria Sanford, who studies human rights, international humanitarian law, the anthropology of genocide, race, and gender in the Americas. And she's the director of the Center for Human Rights and Peace Studies based at Lehman College, City University, New York, and has spent years uncovering evidence of genocide in Guatemala. So something happened here. You know, there's this new phenomenon on Facebook in Guatemala, Justicia Ya, Justice Now.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that social media, as it has affected politics around the world, is starting to have a beneficial effect. Do you think that this movement can build? And obviously they've denied choices, which is how the oligarchies work. The political choices aren't good. The handpicked successor to the criminal class, he didn't make it. But the comedian who did make it has ties to the military because they were his early supporters, the veterans of the who committed the genocide.
Absolutely. He's supported by Kilo Ayuso, who was a commander in the area of Chimaltenango, which is an area where genocide happened. And so he's supported by genocidaires. That party he belongs to is a party supported by the military. And by the way, the current president, Maldonado Aguirre, who's the interim president, who's a former judge, he's not just a former judge. He was a minister underneath the military dictatorship of Carlos Arana from 1970 to 1974. And so, I mean, the military is still very present, even if it's dressed in civilian clothes. in Guatemala, or even in comedians' clothes, right? Yeah. In comic clothes. But I think your question about social media and youth in Central America and elsewhere in the world, majority of voters are youth now. They're young people. They're under 35 in Guatemala. And those big marches in the plaza began because there was a small group of people put up on Facebook, let's meet in the plaza and demonstrate this. And instead of a dozen or two dozen people showing up, 10,000 people showed up. Mm-hmm. And that's the power of social media. And I think that same mobilization is possible for other social issues, but also for the elections if they decide that they want to try to have a different kind of government. And I think they'll be able to hold the government accountable in the same way that they were able to push out Pérez Molina through a democratic process. I think that they'll be able to hold the new government accountable.
So in terms of this election that's taking place on October the 25th after this recent runoff, or this is a runoff as a result of the first election, when the New York Times refers to Sandra Torres as the former, as a leftist former first lady known for her social programs, you seem to disagree with that. You wouldn't call her a leftist. She said she was center-right.
I would say that she's center-right, yes. Uh-huh. And the reason I would say that is because if you look at the military candidates and you look at the political parties in Guatemala, you basically have parties that are oligarchic parties and military parties. And then, I mean, if you want to say a leftist party, that would be the URNG, the former guerrilla. That's a leftist party. But Sandra Torres is not a guerrilla. She's never had any guerrilla affiliations. She's not involved with the guerrilla. So she's not a leftist in that sense. But in Guatemala, a country where the parties are dominated by the military and they're dominated by the oligarchy, if your project represents an alternative to that, which hers does because it's grounded in social programs for poor communities, that's considered to be revolutionary, i.e. subversive, by the forces that be or the powers that be within the country.
Wow. So this is an uphill climb then, to not just dislodge this oligarchy, but to diminish their power and to get revenues flowing to the people who need it, where you have 50% malnutrition amongst children in the richest country in Central America. There's your problem there, right?
Is hunger, literally. Well, hunger for food, hunger for justice, hunger for land, hunger for education.
So obviously throughout the Cold War and going back, you can go back to the coup against the Guatemalan government back in the 1950s under Eisenhower, conducted by the CIA, where they basically, you know, sent a ship full of Czechoslovakian arms to frame this guy who was basically a social democrat. He wasn't even a socialist, or let alone a communist. And they got rid of him. And then they brought these crooks in, these killers. And ever since then, it's been run by these people. So obviously the United States has a huge amount of guilt, whether or not they recognize it or not. How would you rate the current U.S. government? Because I understand, for example, the Drug Enforcement Administration has a huge problem with Guatemala because it's a narco democracy. These rich people are all in bed with narcos. So there's a part of the U.S. government that clearly isn't happy with these characters. But what's the rest of it? Is our CIA, our military, our White House, our State Department, do they know who the real enemy is in this country and what the real problem is? And do they accept the legacy of U.S. guilt in this regard for allowing a bunch of military criminals and thugs to take over a country and murder 200,000 of its own citizens?
Well, President Bill Clinton did. I mean, when Clinton was president, he apologized to the people of Guatemala. And that's a significant legal issue. There are legal scholars who have talked about what does that apology mean? What does that apology mean for future legal cases, for outcomes in genocide cases, for justice in Guatemala? But when the Truth Commission's report came out and said that 200,000 people had been killed, the U.S. ambassador in Guatemala actually said that the Truth Commission had overstepped its mandate and that they weren't supposed to speak about U.S. involvement. That wasn't within the mandate. And President Clinton actually stepped forward and said, that is the mandate of the commission is determined by the commission, not by the U.S. ambassador. And in fact, the United States needs to apologize to the people of Guatemala. Now, the Obama administration apologized to the people of Guatemala for experiments that were done in Guatemala in the 1950s, where they were basically subjecting prisoners, orphans, and people who were in mental asylums to STDs. They were infecting them with syphilis. I don't know if you've seen any of the information about that.
Tuskegee experiments on African Americans.
Well, it's the same Susan Reverby who did that work on Tuskegee, and in her research came across some files that had to do with Guatemala, and she started looking at it, and what she found was actually that doctors had gone down to Guatemala and they were infecting men and women in these mental asylums and orphans with STDs and watching the disease progress.
And who are they with, these doctors? Private companies or with the Center for Disease Control or whatever else?
I think it's what preceded the, I don't think it was called the Center for Disease Control then. It had,
they were U.S. government employees.
Yes, they were funded by the U.S. government, and in tandem with that. And in fact, the Centers for Disease Control, they were involved in doing the research to document when Susan Reverby came across that file. Mm-hmm. They were involved in documenting what had happened there and saying that something, the United States had to take responsibility for that. Mm-hmm. And that's actually the only, only moment I can point to within the Obama administration where there's been any kind of clear policy in Guatemala was to apologize for something that happened in the 1950s. But I think that perhaps because of conflict in other parts of the world, that are the president and Congress as well, there's a missing policy. I don't think we have a coherent policy in Central America, and I think that we really need one. And it shouldn't be driven by the DEA, and it shouldn't be driven by whoever happens to be ambassador there. If we have a good ambassador or a not-so-great ambassador, the United States government should have a policy that supports just development in Central America. And until we have that, we're going to continue to have massive numbers of people fleeing violence in those countries and who are refugees from contemporary violence, as well as people who are economic migrants because the country doesn't offer any opportunities for them. And I think that we've misplaced our policies by not developing a robust policy in Central America.
So when you have the country's first billionaire, basically, given the Forbes rating, and we're talking about Mario Lopez Estrada, if this billionaire is saying that all this would change if the money went to society, but if it continues to be lost, it's impossible. So here you have a billionaire arguing that corruption, particularly with the government, has to end, and the money that should be going to the people that's being siphoned off by these oligarchs and their political hirelings should be going to the money. Can you believe this guy?
Well, I was going to say the next question he should be asked is, what did he pay in taxes last year?
Right.
I don't know. Right.
But your guess is he didn't pay very much.
That would be my guess. I mean, right. I think that those are realistic questions, right? Who's paying taxes in Guatemala? What's the tax base? My sense is that the people who are paying the most taxes are mid-level businesses, small local businesses that have to pay taxes in order to continue to function, because that's where the investigators go to look at records. They don't go to Gallo, the big beer company. They don't go to the big sugar companies or rum companies. They go to the small fries.
Right. Well, this particular guy, Lopez, of course, is the
Tigo.
Tigo, the cell phone billionaire, is I guess the equivalent of one of the richest people in the world, which is the Mexican billionaire. So, is that debate happening? Is anybody saying, okay, you've said the right things? You know, you're saying we've got to correct this corruption. Corruption is our biggest problem, and I think the businesses should support the social movements that emerge from the nation's soul. So he's saying the right stuff.
Well, it's interesting because CACIF, which is basically the Chamber of Commerce of Guatemala, it represents agriculture, commerce, finance, industry. They came forward at the end of August and they supported the national strike. And in fact, they emailed all of the members of the organization saying, go, let your workers go and continue to pay them, let them go to the march, because they wanted Pérez Molina out. What's not clear is if they actually have a real long-term commitment or they just decided we've just got to get rid of him because we're going to lose everything if this continues. So, I think they're really strategic and good at cutting their losses. There's a difference between being strategic and cutting your losses and getting rid of Pérez Molina and actually stepping up to the plate and paying taxes. Because the other thing that needs to happen in Guatemala is a national land survey. And that was one of the recommendations of the Truth Commission in 1996, because there was a lot of land stolen in the process of the war. And former generals took large swaths of land in northern Petén, which is a very rich area agriculturally.
Sure, after murdering all the peasants on the land, right?
Absolutely. And pushing people and pushing people off, murdering people and pushing people off who had been sent up there to colonize, and then after the land had been colonized, and they took it back from them. So that land needs to be surveyed, as do local lands in rural communities. And no one has, and governments have not supported doing that because it's going to mean a redistribution of land. And what will happen in the debate, as soon as they start talking about doing the land surveys, then the big landowners, which are the oligarchy, which are like 1%, 2% of the people own 70% of the land in the country, they'll say, well, land distribution, that will only last for one generation. But what we know from history, if we look at what have been referred to as the tiger states, like Taiwan and Hong Kong and Singapore, those places, that there was redistribution of land after World War II. And that redistribution of land allowed for development in the country. It allowed for the development of middle classes. It allowed for the development of educated classes. And so one generation can make a huge difference. It's not a question of we're going to have like another one generation of more peasants. It's one generation of better, more equal land distribution.
So do you think this cell phone billionaire head of Tigo Lopez is going to support the so-called leftist who's really center-right, or the comedian who's clearly a front for the old guard?
Well, he'll reveal himself when he makes his decision public, won't he? If he supports the comedian, then we'll know who his real allies are.
Right.
Right.
And do you think that if he does support the so-called leftist, will that be an indication of the possibility of change and the fact that 30% of the country's budget will not be lost to corruption?
Well, you know what it might be a signal of is that there are different kinds of capital. I mean, that's one thing that we've seen in Guatemala, I would say, since the 1980s. There's the like old capital, like the old finca capital, the old plantation capital, the like slavocracy capital, right? Mm. And then there's more modern capital that's more involved in the modern systems, from franchises from the United States or Europe up through investment banking and those kinds of finance issues. So if you look at how that capital split off, that's why the peace accords happened, because modern capital decided we're not going to continue this way because we can't exist. Modern capital requires a certain semblance of democracy. It doesn't necessarily have to be really deep, but it requires some semblance of a functioning state.
Sure.
In order to grow. And so if he's a smart capitalist within in modern capital system, then perhaps he is speaking his own truth, and maybe that is what he really believes. I don't know him. I've never met him or interviewed him, but he could possibly represent a new wave. And there are new waves of capitalists that come through and shift the way that capital functions in a country. And if he's representative of a smaller group of people who are powerful because they have wealth, they might be able to trump that old capital that's very entrenched and has the deepest connections to the military.
Right. Well, I guess similarly in this country, you know, there are people like Berkshire Hathaway, and a hugely wealthy country, its head has often said very progressive things, said America's in danger of becoming a plantation economy. The richest guy, Microsoft, Bill Gates, has also indicated some progressive views. And then on the other side, you've got the Koch brothers. So we have our battle of the billionaires
right,
going
absolutely.
On here.
Absolutely.
But just in closing, just back to Guatemala, which, you know, I frankly don't cover it often, but I feel obliged to, and particularly the fact that you're coming to the studio, which is always pleasant to see somebody face-to-face that I've talked to on the phone. What's your parting words for our audience here?
I think to support democratic process in Guatemala, but around the world. And by democratic process, I don't mean elections. I mean the right of people to organize in civil society and make known what their needs are. And today, as I speak with you, I'm incredibly troubled, as I'm sure anyone is, about the condition of Syrian and Afghani and Iraqi refugees on the Serbian-Hungarian border. I was just appalled this morning when I saw the Hungarians opening up water cannons and tear gas on them. And I think that we should be really concerned about the way refugees are treated. And I think that we should be really concerned about language in our country when we talk about immigrants, migrants, and refugees, mm-hmm. and don't vote for Donald Trump.
Well, but just on touching on that, Hungary is led by a right-wing government, Orbán, who has an even more right-wing party to his right, Jobbik. And the conventional political science wisdom is that he's doing all these horrible things because he's got to fend off his right flank. So what that says to me is that this is really about right-wing politics. I mean, you can't just basically fall into the trap of saying that all Hungarians are fascists, because there's obviously some decent people in that country. So I think that we have to be careful about that. And this, to me, is an object lesson in what happens when you have right-wing governments running your country. They're
absolutely
just hideous. And if Senator Ted Cruz were to become president of the United States, we would have similarly ugly scenes on our border with Mexico, I guarantee you.
Right, absolutely. I absolutely agree.
Well, you're supposed to be making statements, not me. But
no, but
here I am
it's,
on a soapbox.
No, but I think that it's a extraordinarily relevant point, and this is the outcome of having fascist parties in power. I mean, if you look at what their reactions are and what they're willing to say to justify their position. I agree. It's not the Hungarian people; it's the Hungarian government. But the end result is that the danger is when the press starts to repeat the language that's being used by those governments and calling people migrants instead of calling them refugees, and watching babies be tear gassed. I mean, it's appalling.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Victoria Sanford.
Thank you very much.
And again, I've been speaking with cultural anthropologist Victoria Sanford, who studies human rights, international humanitarian law, the anthropology of genocide, race and gender in the Americas, and she's the director of the Center for Human Rights and Peace Studies based at Lehman College City University, New York, and has spent years uncovering evidence of genocide in Guatemala. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back with Henry Giroux talking about a casino capitalist's terrifying rise to the top of the GOP in what is an emerging form of new totalitarianism. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Henry Giroux, who is a writer and the current Global Television Network Chair in English and Cultural Studies at McMaster University. Previously, he taught at Boston University and Penn State University. He is the author of The Violence of Organized Forgetting, and his latest book, co-authored with Brad Evans, is Disposable Futures, The Seduction of Violence in the Age of Spectacle. And his latest article at Truthout is Political Frauds and the Ghost of Totalitarianism. Welcome to Background Briefing, Henry Giroux.
Hi, Ian. It's good to be here.
And, of course, the Republican debate featuring the 11 hopefuls with Donald Trump in the center of the stage tonight, I think, is a shocking display, actually. I imagine people around the world are absolutely in dismay. I don't get the feeling in our country that people are sufficiently ashamed and embarrassed about this field of candidates. What's your sense? You're in Canada, so you may have a little bit of a different perspective.
Well, I think that what I see, you know, reading the press here and sort of trying to keep up with the press in the United States, is that, a couple of things are going on. One, I think this all testifies to a massive level of civic illiteracy in the United States. I mean, a total failure to really grasp any sense of history or to understand the ideological strands at work that have brought a person like Donald Trump to the foreground, never mind the other 10 candidates who are on the stage. I mean, I think at another level, I think that, you know, we live at a time in which this logic of casino capitalism is so arrogant that it makes the claim that political correctness is something it has to avoid, because what it really wants to say is that it wants to be upfront and bold and incredibly aggressive about its own racist sort of instincts, its own class-specific instincts, its own hatred of democracy.
And I think that's what we get. I mean, what we're now getting is we're getting the we're getting discourses emerging from a Republican Party that no longer has any clothes. It doesn't need to hide itself anymore. I mean, it's right out front about the nature of its ideology, and I would argue that ideology basically is a precursor of fascism.
Well, let me just quote from your article where I think you're making a very powerful point. What Donald Trump represents is rarely talked about in the mainstream media. He is the most current, egregious, highly visible symbol of a terrifying stage in U.S. society haunted by the protean elements of a new totalitarianism. Totalitarian forms are still with us, but they no longer find expression exclusively in the rounding up and killing of Jews, gay people, people of color, and intellectuals, or in the spectacles of militarism with the heightened show of armies and thugs dressed in military uniforms and black boots. Instead of Nuremberg rallies, we get spectacles of violence and celebrity culture. Instead of public book burnings, we get a culture awash with anti-intellectualism and an attack on critical education. Instead of death camps, we get a system of mass incarceration. The new totalitarianism is echoed in the resurgence of religious bigotry that runs through U.S. society like an electric current and is personified in the media celebration of bigots such as Kentucky's clerk Kim Davis, who believes that her religion gives her the right to both deny marriage licenses to same-sex couples and disavow the separation of church and state. I think you've nailed it, Henry.
No, I think that really says it all. I'm not at all, but it certainly points in a fundamental way to what Trump and his friends represent. I mean, I think there's two things that are going on for me that I'm troubled by. One is I don't like the utter personification of Trump in the media, in which we simply talk about him as eccentric, loudmouth. I mean, he's symptomatic of something. I think this collapse of the public into the private, this attempt to privatize the kind of systemic problems that face the United States really makes people stupid. I mean, it's sort of like talking about the Kardashians. You know, let's talk about what Kim wore today as opposed to talking about what kind of society produces these idiots and why are they so popular? What kinds of needs are they really fulfilling? And I think that what we've lost and what we're seeing in this episode with Trump are three things. We've lost the sense of historical consciousness and public memory. Everything is moving so fast in the American press, in the American media, that we no longer talk about history. Secondly, it seems to be we've lost the ability to translate private issues into public problems, into systemic problems. And I think thirdly, we have no sense of how powerful the educational force of the culture is, given that it's in the hands of relatively six corporations, and what the price is that we pay for that, which is a kind of civic illiteracy and a kind of bigotry and a kind of racism that turns the United States into a country that once in some way applauded the ideals of a democracy to one that now is basically a punishing state.
So I sort of trace the roots of our political anti-intellectualism. I mean, there's no question there's a history of cultural anti-intellectualism in the United States going back to the Know-Nothing Party in the 19th century. But in terms of modern politics or recent politics, it seems that John McCain's ascension and choice of Sarah Palin as his vice president, somebody that was clearly thoroughly unqualified, broke a kind of tradition in American politics where at least people voted for candidates that they thought were a little more qualified and a little more intelligent than they were. And somehow or other, when McCain brought Palin into the mix, ever since then, it's been a downhill slide where people basically are encouraged to vote for people that are just like they are.
I think you're right, but I think you're only partly right. I mean, at least for me. What I see is happening is that since the 1980s and the ascension of Ronald Reagan to the presidency, there's a kind of crude, instrumental, anti-intellectual, religious extremism, a number of fundamentalisms that all of a sudden come to the surface of American society. And in doing so, they've created a formative culture steeped in a massive form of illiteracy. And I'll tell you what they are. One is a kind of religious fundamentalism, which now, I mean, actually shapes curricula in some schools, you know, rooted in stupidity and myth and nothing more than a kind of a form of ideological baggage that you know, no first grader should basically take up. Secondly, you have a kind of economic fundamentalism in which we say that the only interests that matter are private interests. The only form of individualism that matters is possessive individualism. So there's no interest in the larger world anymore. There's no interest in what it means to relate, you know, to other people in ways in which are mediated by shared responsibilities. Third is a kind of militarism that has taken over the economy. Everybody's a warrior, and every school basically is now a punishing institution rooting out terrorists or emulating war zones. I mean, when you have an 11-year-old kid, as we know, in the ninth grade today in the United States, who is in Texas, who's handcuffed because he brings in a homemade radio, is handcuffed and put in jail. You know, here's a kid who wanted to show his teacher how creative he was, you know, a kind of tech-savvy kid. You know, we begin to see, you know, what's going on here. And the fourth one, is, of course, the anti-intellectualism rooted in the educational system. I mean, you've got two political parties who basically say to young people today, we want you to be stupid. We want you to teach, we're going to teach you to learn how to fill in bubbles on a test. And the last thing we're going to do is allow you to be creative. We're going to kill your imagination. And then, of course, the fifth thing I guess we should mention is the preponderance of a culture that's commodified, commercialized, and rooted in a kind of celebrity idiocy. You know, you put these factors together, and that's a very distinctive historical conjuncture. One is very different from the 1970s and 60s, and I think we're really paying a price for it.
So, Henry, then, is there a learning curve here? I mean, if there's this vast conspiracy to dumb down America, and it's clearly working, what is the end game? Why would the oligarchs, the elite in this country, want America the stupid?
Well, they don't want to face any kind of resistance. They don't want what they do questioned. They don't want power held accountable, and they want people to believe that the society in which they live, for which they live, is there are no alternatives. I mean, I think that this is basically an ideological war of the first proportions. I think the left has, in many cases, has vastly underestimated the educational centrality of politics itself. And that culture basically has become a vast machine of repression. And the other side of this, of course, is that you can look at Bernie Sanders, and one could say, wow, I mean, here's a guy who at least is providing an alternative discourse that is, in some ways, not only waking people up, but inspiring them and energizing them. And I think that, you know, whether you like Sanders or not, you know, what at least he represents for me is the force of a kind of pedagogy, of the force of a pedagogy at the center of politics that's really there to educate people and to move them. And that gives you hope. I mean, there are sites of resistance. I mean, there are places in the university. There are some public schools. There are some public spheres, you know, that are really waging a very intense intellectual, cultural, and political war against this kind of fascism, this new breed of totalitarianism. But they're marginalized. I mean, that's the issue. I think that I'm not sure that Sanders is a tipping point, because I think that Sanders is deluded by being in the Democratic Party. But I do think that the more we hear alternative discourses in alternative languages, the more we get a discourse outside of the manufactured nonsense, you know, that's produced in the mainstream cultural apparatuses, discourses that you hear in a program like this. I mean, there's always the hope to mobilize people in the face of what are becoming contradictions that are just untenable. I mean, you can't go on destroying the earth like this. You know, you just can't go on destroying public goods, public spaces, public schools, eliminating social provisions before people either are going to move to the right in a massive way, as indicated by Trump, or they're going to move more to the left and organize collectively and recognize that this system is broken. They don't live in a democracy anymore. This is not a democracy. And I think that what we'll see tonight is all the evidence that's necessary to make that clear.
Well, to be fair to Bernie, though, you know, I helped organize his big rally he did here in Los Angeles that he claims is what inspired him to run for president. And I know the guy, and he's running as a Democrat for purely practical reasons, because he wants to get in the debates and wants to be able to join in the political discourse in this country. As a third-party candidate, you are absolutely destined for oblivion. And so
I know the logic and I know the argument. I don't contest the fact that you have to be in a two-party system to be heard. What I contest the fact is a system in which there's only a two-party system.
Sure.
There are only two parties. I mean, I think that's the politics.
Right.
I mean, they're both big money. They're both big money apparatuses. They're both beholden to financial interests tend to dictate what they do. And I think if Bernie can somehow turn the Democratic Party around to the point where it doesn't recognize itself anymore, that would be fine. You know?
Well, his average donation is about $31. So he's not.
That's good.
He's different from the others, shall we say?
I mean, it's going to be interesting to see if he wins the nomination, and I certainly hope he does. It's really going to be interesting to see what this money machine on the right attempts to do to him. You can just imagine. I mean, what the discourse is going to be? He's a communist. He's a socialist. They're going to nationalize your houses. I mean, this is really going to be interesting.
Well, that's the extraordinary disconnect here, the amazing double standard.
You can say
the stupidest things on the right and be taken seriously.
Right.
And if you say the most intelligent and cogent things on the left, you're considered a loon or an
illusion. That should be broken down a bit, because I think, you know, for me, you've said something enormously serious and important. And I think it needs to be analyzed, because I think that what often happens in the mainstream media, which is what people mostly listen to, is that you get idiots who are flat earth people who will say something, and the media will, of course, intervene and say, well, on the other side you have this. So there's really no attempt to get at the truth, and there's no attempt to separate opinion from informed arguments. I mean, what you get is a hodgepodge of nonsense that flattens out any possibility for either a sense of what it means to be a journalist and be committed to something, and what the truth might mean, and what it might look like, and how you might assess it. I mean, you know, I'm watching this. I watch all the news networks every night, the three major news networks in the United States, and I find myself screaming at the television. I mean, the coverage is so bad. It's so anti-intellectual. I mean, it's shameful. I mean, they couldn't. You know, you would. This wouldn't happen in Canada. You have public radio, right? You have CBC. They would never allow that to happen. But in the United States, you've got a formative culture that supports people like, you know, Ted Cruz, supports people like Huckabee's an embarrassment. I mean, how else can you talk about Huckabee? I mean, a guy who supports, basically, who does not support the separation of church and state, or who says no woman should have an abortion under any circumstances, even if her life is at risk. I mean, that's tantamount to a war crime.
Well, again, it's this weird double standard. And Henry, I appreciate you joining us here today. And
All right,
let's stay in touch. We'll make a regular feature of the Canadian reality check.
I'd love to do that.
Okay,
that would be great. Thanks, Ian.
Thank you.
Bye bye.
And again, I've been speaking with Henry Giroux, who's a writer and the current Global Television Network Chair in English and Cultural Studies at McMaster University. Previously, he taught at Boston University and Penn State University, and he is the author of The Violence of Organized Forgetting, and his latest book, co-authored with Brad Evans, is Disposable Future, The Seduction of Violence in the Age of Spectacle. And his latest article at Truthout is Political Frauds and the Ghost of Totalitarianism. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.